all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type, United States Army Aviation, 1967 to 71. Wow, that's 100 years ago, isn't it? Pretty close to it anyway. I want to say to all my veteran brothers and sisters, thank you so much for your service. And to all of you that have made it home safely, we want to tell you thank you again and welcome home. We are here for you. Veterans Radio is veterans for veterans. Everything about the whole program is veteran-oriented, and that's what we want to talk about today. We're going to be telling a great story, and this is really kind of hit home with me, as those of you who have been listening to Veterans Radio over the last number of years. I did fly helicopters in Vietnam, and I was involved with, now I can legally talk about it because a 30-year time period has expired. I was involved in special observation group over there, Command and Control South, and we ran teams of Special Forces units into Cambodia, Laos, and so forth over there before it was popular. And today's book that we're going to be talking about is Legend, and it's written by Eric Blum, and it's the story of a Medal of Honor recipient, and I'll get into that in a little bit more, but it's a very exciting story because he was part of a team that had gone into Cambodia, into places that I had been a year after this story took place. And so I'm excited to tell that whole story. In the meantime, we've got a number of events that are coming up, and I want to make sure that you tell us what events are going on in your area of the country. You can send us an email, or you can go to our website at veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, and we'll get out whatever information that you want us to get out. The event that occurred was some news that I got from one of our listeners. And, you know, we're always encouraging you here on Veterans Radio to get a hold of the VA and make sure at least that you're registered, and so that if anything does come up, then possibly you can, you know, get a little jump on the system and get involved in there. And if you're entitled to benefits for a disability or something that might have been caused by your exposure to something, at least you've got the ball started to roll. But I got this email, and it talks about the Brown Water Navy over in Vietnam, and then it talks about the Mobile Ravine Force Inshore Fire Support. I'm not from the Navy, so I don't understand hardly any of this, but it said that it says Mobile Ravine Force Inshore Fire Support, ISF Division 93. If you were listed on many of these different ships, you might have been exposed and probably were exposed to herbicides. And it talks about that these types of ships now qualify for presumption of herbicide exposure. And I'm just going to list a couple of them. Those in your Navy, you probably have gotten this yourselves. You may know about it already. But it says AGP, Assault Group Patrols, LCMs, Landing Craft Mechanized, LCUs, Landing Craft Utility, LSTs, PBR, Patrol Boat River, PCF, Patrol Craft After Swift Boats, STABs, Strike Assault Boats, WAKs, Cargo Vessels, there's Buoy Tenders, this list is pretty long, Patrol Boats, Harbor Utility Craft, and so on and so forth. So, if you want more information on this, remember Bob always says make sure you have a pen when you're listening to Veterans Radio, is to go to this website, and it's www.publichealth.va.gov/exposures. And on that there, you'll be able to find a list. When you look under Agent Orange, under that particular page, you'll be able to find a list of all of the ships that are designated, I guess you could say, to qualify for presumption of herbicide exposure. Now, again, all of us who were in Vietnam, there is a presumption of herbicide exposure. I know that the VA always wants to know, where were you in country and when were you there? And for some of us, we didn't know where we were half the time because every day we were in 25 different towns or villages or whatever it happened to be. But if you think that you have any health issues caused by exposure to herbicides, get to the VA now. Get that claim in, and let them, you know, let's start the process going, because there's a lot of things going on out there. Remember, we talked about Agent Orange before, where it not only affects our generation, but there's proof that it affects our children's generation, and now they are finding out that it affects our grandchildren's generation. So we encourage you to get involved with this. You know, find out if there's anything going on in your physical system caused by Agent Orange. Do it, please. This is really important to you. We're going to take a break right now, and then we're going to be back with our guest, author Eric Blem, and his book is entitled Legend, The Incredible Story of Green Beret Sergeant Roy Benavidez, his mission to rescue a special forces team caught behind enemy lines. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest, these are men.
These are America's best, and this is what we're going to be talking about with our guest, Eric Blem, today on Veterans Radio. And, Eric, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, so nice to be here, and I'll just echo what you said earlier. Thank you to all your listenership who have served their families. Thank you for your service and just enabling us this freedom of speech to have an open conversation about whatever we want on the radio here in America.
It is, isn't it? And now, actually, we can talk about these missions 30 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a world that I was thoroughly not aware of the year it took place. I was born, 1968, the mission that we were going to talk about, May 2nd, 1968. And there really wasn't a whole lot in the history books, even as I got into school a decade later, that really gave me any enlightenment into what the men and women did in Vietnam.
Well, you have written a number of other books, but we're going to talk about those a little bit later on. But let's talk about how you got involved with this story of Roy Benavidez, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. My wife says I can't pronounce anything, so.
You know what, Benavidez, you got it.
Oh, right.
Kind of that whole, like, we all got taught on phonics, right? And
yeah.
There you go. I'll tell you about, first of all, I got into writing these stories. I was out of college in journalism. I was an editor of a snowboarding magazine. I wrote about adventures and fun stuff that we get to enjoy in this country. But after 9/11, I asked myself, what's your part in all this? I never did serve in the military. And I thought that, you know, my gift, my skill is writing and research. And I wanted to tell the stories of those who serve from the perspective of those who are there on the ground without any political bias, without any religious bias, without any sort of bias at all, just straight and narrow from the perspective of the guys and, in some cases, women who are there. And so that's how I got into writing these types of stories. In particular, I wrote books about our current and currently past wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and from there, after a fairly decent following of readership, I was given an email from my agent. Actually, it was my agent's mom told me about Roy Benavidez's story, and I at first could not believe it. And she said, I think this should be your next book. And, you know, the short of the story is that this is a guy that was wounded more than 30 times in the process of trying to help rescue a special forces team caught behind enemy lines. And it detailed some of the wounds that he got, and I thought, this cannot be real. But I did my due diligence and my research and asked around and found out, no, this is for real. And I thought, you know what, this is a story that the current generation of readership, both military and civilian, need to hear. And that's what urged me and encouraged me to really dig deep and tell this story.
Well, it is a fascinating story. And I'm trying to put it into historical perspective on my own basis. In 1968, I was in flight school getting ready to go to Vietnam. And in doing a little research on your story, I found that my company, the 195th Assault Helicopter Company, who had been running the missions with Team 56, had pretty much broken all their aircraft in early May of 68. And the other company, the 240th Assault Helicopter Company, the Greyhounds, took over the mission for, I think it was 6 weeks or 2 months, something along those lines, before we got enough aircraft to go back and take over again. And as a result, they were thrown right into the middle of this truly amazing adventure.
Yeah, the 240th, they had had a really amazing, from talking to the guys who were part of the 240th, and to step back even a step further, Roy Benavidez's story had been told in various angles in the past, but what had never been told was the story of the Salt Helicopter Company that took them on this mission and then also, of course, gave a lot to try and get these guys out. And I thought that in Vietnam, as you know, you really can't tell a story of a mission, a ground mission, without also telling the story from the air, because they really went hand in hand in Vietnam. The first, you know, the air mobile tactics with helicopters, all this originated in Vietnam. And so that was kind of an interesting perspective of this book that I really wanted to cover. And they had such a great track record up until the year of 1968, the Greyhounds, and then all of a sudden, just significant losses. Yet I was told over and over again that they never said no to a mission, that it didn't matter how hot the landing was. And I think it really went true for most of the Salt Helicopter Companies. They wanted to get their brothers out. And if they put them in, they wanted to get them out. And that really is a big part of this story.
I think it's a big story about Americans' military in general, is that, you know, traditionally we have never left anybody behind. And it was kind of ingrained in us that if we did, you know, if somebody was on the ground, for my, you know, being a pilot, it was our job to go and get them no matter what happened. And I think luckily that the majority of us were young enough where we didn't think about what we were doing, and all, because, you know, nothing would ever hurt us, that we would go and get them. And so many of the stories in this book, and we're talking with Eric Blem, and his book is entitled Legend, and it's just fascinating. For any of you who are in Vietnam, you've got to read this thing. So many of you probably were in firefights that were very similar, hopefully not as bad as these were, and if you were a pilot or a door gunner, crew chief, they've got everything in here. He's put everything in here that tells your story about what you did in there. And when I was reading it about the towns and the villages and the names and everything, it all came flashing back to me. But let's go back and let's start talking about Roy, because this is about him, because his story starts nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was born in rural Texas. He was orphaned at a very young age. His father died when he was 3. His mother died when he was 7, both from tuberculosis. They were sharecroppers, you know, they were vaqueros, cowboys working for a ranch, the Wallace Ranch, outside of Cuero, Texas. And after his parents were killed, he was adopted by an uncle who already had, you know, a half dozen kids. And him and his younger brother were brought on board. And so this is a kid that grew up in the racially turbulent South. He grew up in a family of Mexicans that were experiencing racism just like the African Americans in the South at the time. When he went to a movie as a boy, he was ushered to the balcony where there were signs posted that said Mexicans and Negroes to the balcony. Mm-hmm. And that was what he grew up with. And I say that as part of the story to just show how it turned around to then, this instilled in him this desire to serve his country, the very country that he, you know, was experiencing these challenges as a very young person battling poverty, racism, prejudice, you name it, as a young boy. But as a teenager, he ultimately dropped out of school to continue helping the family to make ends meet as a sharecropper, picking sugar beets and cotton, and then got a job at a Firestone store. And one day a recruiter came by and asked if he could put a recruiting sign up for the Army. And Audie Murphy was the kind of the poster boy at the time during the Korean War in the 50s. Yeah. And Roy thought of Audie Murphy as a hero. His uncle had told him how Audie Murphy came from a family of sharecroppers, a white boy who picked cotton himself as a young man. And he was always kind of a hero to Roy. And that's what kind of instigated that, let's say, military wanderlust, where he wanted to see, hey, maybe the military is for me. And he was encouraged by his family, by his uncle, by Art Haddock, who was the manager of the Firestone store, that, you know what, you can't let your circumstances hold you back. You need to bring honor to your name. You're first and foremost an American, and the military is a pretty good option for you. And he went that route, and sure enough, he went down in the annals of history as truly a legend.
He did. And one of the things that I always found that I found fascinating in the story was the influence that his grandfather had on him about how to live your life. Could you just touch on that briefly?
His grandfather, Salvador, he would go and pick sugar beets in particular early. He'd get told out of school a month and a half before school let out for most kids, and he'd go back to school a month after most started. So for about 5 months, with the summer in the middle, he'd be picking crops. And on these various living in shanty towns near the crops and whatever in Colorado, in Texas, he would sit around campfires at night, and his grandfather, Salvador, would tell stories. And his grandfather had been a vaquero. He very proudly wore a Stetson hat and a big belt buckle, and he told the story of how one time one of his fellow ranch hands went off of a small trail on a narrow, mountain gorge, and he had to get down on all fours, took his belt off, and helped this guy up at his own risk on a very slippery slope, and almost, could have succumbed to a slip and died himself. And the lesson that he constantly repeated over and over again over the years to Roy and to his fellow, his cousins, his adopted cousins, who were like brothers and sisters, and his own little brother, was, if someone needs help, you help them. It was as simple as that. And that really came full circle, years later in Vietnam, when he heard this call for help from this special forces team that was vastly outnumbered, outgunned, being slaughtered. And he was the first to jump in line and say, hey, I'm going to go see what I can do to help him out.
Well, it's an amazing story. We're talking with Eric Lim, author of Legend, the story of Roy Benavidez's heroic mission, for which he rightfully deserved and finally received his Medal of Honor. If you've got a question for Eric or you want to jump in on the story, please give us a call here at Veterans Radio. Our number locally is 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. Or if you're out somewhere in America, you can call us at toll-free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. All right, so Roy enlisted, and for some reason he decided he wanted to go to jump school. I'm always amazed by people that want to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. But but he wanted to be the best, right?
Yeah, he did. And he was recently married, and to Lala, his long wife until the day that he died. And he thought of it as two things. One was, hey, it's a few extra bucks on my paycheck every month.
That's true.
And also that there was this desire that he knew that they were looked up to. And there was, again, this recurring message, from his uncle, who often said, if you're going to do something, whether it's picking crops or whatever it is, be the best. Do the best that you can do. And no one can ever fault you for that. And when he heard about the jump school and that possibility, it was exciting to him. And he tried out for it and ultimately made it. But it wasn't an easy path. He tried to enlist for it many, many times, and he ultimately got a job. He was a good guy. He had the gift of gab. He always was a great storyteller because his family had this oral tradition of telling stories. And so he ultimately became a chauffeur for a time. And as luck would have it, he was given the assignment when he was at a fort. It's escaping me right now which fort it was, but it was there in Texas. Westmoreland came to the fort where he was working, and he got to chauffeur him personally. And after being turned down for jump school a few times, he knew at the time Westmoreland was the top dog in the airborne. And by the end of his stay there, what he kind of hinted to Westmoreland that that's what he wanted to do. And it was kind of a gift, because right before he had the opportunity to reenlist at the end of that year, he got orders to attend jump school. And they were from Westmoreland himself, giving him a chance, because he did something with Westmoreland. He showed something, his spirit, his story, whatever it was, that reminded and had Westmoreland actually wrote down his name when he left that duty station. And that was what really gave him the opportunity to start this whole journey. And it's just interesting. If you believe in a higher power, a lot of pieces to the puzzle come together with this story, because the fact that William S. Westmoreland, who ultimately became the commanding general in Vietnam, met him early on and gave him that opportunity, that chance to go for airborne and to try out. It's amazing. When I put together the pieces and I had to check his military records, these things that I heard were almost legendary circumstances, you know, they all lined up, and I found the facts and the truth behind it. And sure enough, it all pulled together, and it was just a neat thing to put together, because I always research everything very deeply and very carefully to make sure, you know, is it legend or is it truth that becomes legend?
Yeah,
and
and
as we know, things over the course of many, many years and decades upon decades, the fog of war and just the fog of age really can blur things. And, man, his story is amazing. And I'm telling you, it's just all of it panned out. All of it I found very accurate.
Well, that's true. Now, he went, not only did he go through jump school, he went through Ranger school and ended up, you know, as in the Special Forces. And,
yes.
You know, he got that coveted Green Beret, with, you know, that's a song that we were played on earlier on. But he had been in Vietnam one other time before 1968 and ran into difficulty, right?
Yeah, and that's really, I mean, that's a part of the story that is, you know, I don't go super deep into it because there's so much to put at the end of the story with this true mission that ultimately gave him that, you know, the credibility and opportunity to be eligible for that coveted Medal of Honor. But during the first waves of our support in Vietnam in 65, he was there, and I'll just cut it right to the chase. He stepped on a landmine, was what they ultimately put together, the medical people put together, because he was found on a trail after a patrol. And he was the impact in his body. He was unconscious. He was in a coma. His spine had been compressed. He had a gigantic bruise on his butt. and just somehow this mine that he stepped on did not explode. So rather than ended up in a million pieces, he ended up concussed thoroughly and compressed. And he went back to Fort Sam Houston and was told he would, first of all, when he came to, he didn't even recognize who his wife was, and he was that bad. They didn't know if he'd ever regain his senses. And then once that came to and they realized that he was paralyzed and numb, you know, could not feel any sensations from the waist down, that he would never walk again. But he continued to go to the little chapel at the ward where he was, where there were other people coming back from Vietnam. You know, there were people with the amputees, multiple amputees, burn victims. And he kept on just saying, why, God, why did I survive? I wish I would have gotten my legs blown off and I would have never made it here, because he saw himself as this person who was going to go home. He's going to get a medical retirement because he's going to be good for nothing. And he said, and this is in his own words, the only thing back in El Campo, Texas, where he ended up growing up with his uncle, is that dumb Mexican, Roy Benavidez. There's not Sergeant Benavidez, the man who he'd become and that he dreamed to become, who could serve his country. And after many months in the hospital, he one night started to feel a little bit of sensation, and he actually pushed himself. He could use his arms. He pushed himself off of his bed, slammed onto the ground, and he attempted to push himself up against the wall in the ward where his buddies were all lined up, again, some of them amputees. And he ultimately was taken by the nurse and said, you can't do this, you know, don't push yourself out of the bed. He said, I just want to walk. And he kept giving himself his own sort of physical therapy, and then he was going to real physical therapy. And slowly, under painful circumstances, he got to the point where he did have some feeling, and he was able to bear his own weight. And long story short, again, a lot of this is covered in the book, but he was able to actually walk out of the hospital. And at that point, you'd think that he's done, but he refused to medically retire. And then he decided, hey, I think what I'm going to do is see if I can't become a Green Beret. He just has had that unstoppable spirit.
And determination and just strength of, as you mentioned, determination. I mean, not only is he not blown apart, but blown up, probably traumatic brain injury and all these other things. And then he decides he's going to become a Green Beret, whose training is even more difficult than jump school and all the other things. So we've got about a minute before we take a break at the bottom of the hour when we're talking with Eric Blem here. And his book is entitled Legend, and it's a story of Roy Benavidez. And his when we come back after the news, we're going to be talking about his adventures on in May of 1968 when he volunteered. This is the thing that's so amazing to me, is that he volunteered to go out and to attempt to rescue a Green Beret team that was surrounded in Cambodia. So make sure that you stay tuned. Again, if we want to get in on the conversation, please give us a call here at Veterans Radio, 734-822-1600, toll free, 844-838-1600. So in the 30 seconds that's left, Eric, Roy went to Special Forces school, got his Green Beret, and now he's going to go back to Vietnam, correct?
He's going back to Vietnam. He doesn't know really what he's going to do, but he knows that he's going to, in at a much older age than many young Green Berets. He was in his 30s, and he doesn't know what's in store for him, but he knows that he's going to get a chance to serve his country once again.
Okay, so stay tuned for the second half of Veterans Radio. We're going to be talking about Roy Benavidez and the mission that he went on that earned him the Medal of Honor. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. We're back on Veterans Radio. For those that are familiar with Veterans Radio, that's the theme from our Medal of Honor series that we normally run during this time period. We haven't made a Medal of Honor segment yet for Roy, so we got to just put the music in there. Joining us here on Veterans Radio today is Eric Blem, the author of Legend, which is the unforgettable account, and Courageous Actions of the U.S. Army's 240th, 240th Assault Helicopter Company, and Green Beret Staff Sergeant Roy Benavidez. Eric, I was looking in your book, and I was recalling when I got to Vietnam, and they said, okay, these are the missions that you're going to be flying. I just wanted to remind our audience that a helicopter company is made up of four platoons. There are two slick platoons. These are the troop carriers and so forth. There's a gun platoon, and then there's the maintenance platoon. And, you know, the guys that fix everything all the time. And a slick helicopter has four people on board normally. There's a pilot, co-pilot, crew chief, and a door gunner. And, you know, we can fit, depending on the weather, altitude, and density, altitude, and so forth, we can usually carry 6 to 8 Americans on board, and usually more Vietnamese because they were smaller. And the when we were assigned this mission to fly with the ours was Command and Control South, is that they took away all of our identification. We didn't wear any dog tags. We weren't allowed to carry wallets, jewelry, anything along those lines that would give anybody any idea who we were. And that if we were behind, if we got shot down behind enemy lines, we had this silk, I don't know what you'd call it, like a chit almost, and then five different dialects of Cambodian or Vietnamese, it would say, if you help this person get back to friendly lines, there was a reward for you, and on the other side there was a panel to help people out. This is the scenario that the 240th ran into when they signed up for this mission. So on May 8th, or May 2nd of 1968, off they go on a mission to drop a team of special forces, which usually with two Americans and was it four indigenous?
It really depends on the group. In this case, it was a heavy team, so
okay.
It was three Americans, and it was, six indigenous.
Okay. And so the mission was to do what? I guess I'll let you explain that.
They were interdicting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They were there to watch and or, you know, along the way they would do things like hit wiretaps so they can listen in on the enemy communications that were there, the communists, the North Vietnamese that were using the Ho Chi Minh Trail to bring supplies and personnel down into South Vietnam. where the war was taking place, kind of a backdoor entrance into the war, because we had it pretty wrapped up on the borders and even up on the the northern border as well. So they went into neutral, Laos and Cambodia, breaking the international law of those countries' designation as neutral. And they so people often say, we were supposed to be in Cambodia. Well, we were in a very small scale, as opposed to the North Vietnamese and communist Chinese who were supporting them, that were using the same trail. And in some ways, with the kind of underside acknowledgement, quiet nod from the Cambodian Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who was also a very colorful character from that period, who was kind of playing all sides of the fence. So that's kind of the that's the setting of these guys that were they were trying. One of the big things they wanted to do was try and find the command and control center of the North Vietnamese down here in the south. And many believed it was in this area known as either the Fish Hook or the Parrot's Beak, where Cambodia jutted out into South Vietnam, the border. And that was the Fish Hook was where this team was inserted, to an area where they were very confident that there was a lot of enemy movement from past missions. And they were, as a secondary option in this, they were told that they couldn't hijack an enemy truck to kind of see what's
like
inside of these trucks.
They wanted to bring back a truck.
a truck from the, yeah, and do it quietly, if that's at all possible. And they did, you know, the idea was that if they did get it, they could use maybe one of the big sky cranes, the big, massive, heavy-lift helicopters, potentially even drive it back across the border, because there were roads that went right onto the border. I mean, it's a massive border, and there were areas where they could do this. But they wanted to see what was inside these, and that was secondary to just, again, counting troop movements. And, you know, if given the opportunity, they were sometimes given permission to raise a little hell with the enemy as well. And it really depended. At this time in particular, they were, the real goal was to stay quiet. The truck was kind of a pie in the sky aspect of the mission that they were encouraged to go after if it was possible. But what happened is shortly after being inserted, they were compromised. They ran into some woodcutters who were clearly North Vietnamese. I mean, these woodcutters that also had AK-47s, are flung over their shoulders, and they were there, and they had to deal with them. And in doing so, they went into a evade and retreat situation where they wanted to get to a landing zone. And then at that point, they also ran headlong into an equally sized patrol of North Vietnamese. And that was really when everything went to hell for the team.
Right, and in essence, they were basically surrounded. They had just been dropped off by the 240th, and these guys immediately had to turn. This has happened quite often, because they would many times pick three landing sites or LZs to, you know, confuse the enemy, because they didn't, you know, I mean, they could figure out where a helicopter is landing, and sometimes they would set up these landing zones, you know, thinking, well, they're going to land here, so we'll wait for them. And it just seems by accident that this particular team went into this LZ, and they were very close to a large, large contingent of North Vietnam regulars. And so once this firefight ensued, they were totally compromised, and they lost a couple of their team members right away.
Yes.
And then they had to call to the 240th, to the Greyhounds, for them to come back and get them. And can you tell a little bit? I don't want to give away the whole book, obviously. I want people to read this book.
It's interesting, because when you discuss this, it's everything that we're talking about is the same thing that just got me intrigued by to tell the story. And there's so many details, as you know, having read it yourself, that it doesn't matter if you hear the story right here. You read it, and it's just, there's so many things that will just drop your jaw when you find out what they went through. I mean, I think it's always most telling to those who – it's haunting to those who have experienced combat. And it's telling, and for those of us who have not, to just say that they were stacking the bodies of their dead as cover, because they were surrounded, they were low on ammunition, they could only carry so much on these missions, and they were being just shot to heck with everything from rocket propelled grenades to standard, you know, rifle and pistol fire, but also there were some crew served machine guns that were being rolled in around them in this clearing, and they basically found a small little island of trees, is how that was described to me, in the middle of this clearing that was really not, it was kind of like a crescent shaped clearing, maybe 130 yards long by 70 yards across, and in the middle of this is where they had gone to try and get picked up. There was an ant hill, an earthen ant hill, and some saplings. And other than that, they were surrounded by tall grass, and then they were surrounded by the whole clearing was surrounded by just that classic wall of jungle that is so prevalent around these clearing areas. And within this tree line was where the enemy was slowly encircling them, and they had almost completely encircled them when finally the 240th got back in, because it was a decent time flight. They had to get back out after they dropped them off. They had to refuel, and then they had to come back out. And by the time they got there, it was so hot that they really were having difficulties getting in. In fact, the one helicopter that landed, this probably would have just haunted you hearing it, but the Special Forces team did not want to be compromised and let anyone know where their position was, so they were keeping it quiet. But as the helicopter landed, they looked across the clearing, and they saw a group of North Vietnamese coming out into the clearing, brazenly waving hello and to try and wave the helicopter down. Well, these teams would wear the uniforms of the enemy. And so the helicopter pilot saw these guys coming out of the tree line thinking, oh, this is the team. This is who we're picking up. And the other guys are like, we don't want to open fire because we don't know where these guys are, but we hope they can figure out that these are not us. These are the bad guys. And ultimately, when the helicopter got all the way down, they did open fire on this team of or this patrol of North Vietnamese who was, you know, trying to act as though they were an American team, and that's when the firefight started with the helicopters, and they barely escaped, shot to heck. And during this situation, this first attempt to get in and pull these guys out, one of the door gunners, Michael Craig, was shot mortally through the chicken plate, through the armor under the chest, and he flew back to Loc Ninh, which was the base near the Cambodian border where Roy Benavidez ended up. That was the first place after he had been stationed with B-56. He was sent to this little forward base, and he was kind of just getting to know what the SOG group, what the Studies and Observation group was all about, kind of defined what his place was going to be. And that's when he saw a helicopter pilot running for the tarmac where the helicopters would come in across near a very small landing strip. And he ran up there and he sees this helicopter limping back over the landing with a really hard landing. It was trailing smoke.
Right.
And he sees the pilot waving and yelling out, medic, medic. Well, Roy, of course, Special Forces, everybody's cross-trained. He's a medic. He runs straight to this helicopter. And Michael Craig is bleeding profusely all over the bottom of the helicopter, and he takes him in his arms, pulls him out of the helicopter to see what he can do, and he immediately realizes that this young door gunner, crew chief, who was 20 years old, I mean, young man looking up into Roy's eyes with that look of terror in his eyes, and Roy being trained to stay calm, just talk to him. And the last words out of Michael Craig's mouth were, "My God, my mom and dad." Mm-hmm. And then he died in Roy's arms. And you can imagine, here is a situation where Roy, he's there just to kind of help out and give support on the ground and figure out what's going on with this group. He's not on this mission. He's not even on a standby mission that's supposed to be a quick reaction force for any situation like this. He's just there kind of hanging out, getting his feet wet. And he immediately, looks around. He sees another helicopter. He sets down Michael Craig gently on the tarmac, and he walks over the next helicopter and he asks the pilot, who was Larry McKibben, another young man, if they're going back in. And he said, "Well, you're going to need a belly man. I'm here to help you out." And he jumps on board.
So that, without any weapons, by the way, folks.
Yeah. No,
he was
on his way to breakfast. All he had in his pocket was a bottle of Tabasco sauce, and he had his Special Forces knife, which over time, I will say, had grown to 14 inches long and a small machete, but in reality, it was a classic 7 or 8 inch blade.
Right. Right. So this is what he gets on this helicopter, and the 240th takes him back into that landing zone.
Yeah.
And it gets worse.
It does. It just culminates, and when you don't think it gets any worse, it gets worse and worse and worse. And on the ground, there was a very brave Special Force soldier. His name was Brian O'Connor, along with the assistant team leader, and Brian was the radio man, and he was helping to coordinate. That they had all been shot up profusely. They were all losing blood. They were putting in their own blood expanders. They were tourniquets, helping out each other with tourniquets, all these things. And Roy, he flies in with Larry McKibben, and he just says, I can't get in. It's too hot. And Larry really wants to get in. Mm-hmm. And he ultimately is told by Roy, get me as close as you can. And so he goes to the far end of this clearing, part of the clearing that has not yet been encircled by enemy, but is still on two sides flanked, and the front in the middle of this clearing is the team. And Roy says, get me as close as you can. He gets to about a 15-foot hover, and Roy crosses himself. He was a devout Roman Catholic, crosses himself multiple times and jumps. He jumps with a medical bag. And on the way out on this flight, he realized his faux pas. He realized the ultimate mistake that he did that, you know, even a buck private should never do is he went into battle without a weapon.
Right.
And he landed on the ground and he immediately starts running and everybody's honing in on him. I mean, when a helicopter comes into a landing zone and surrounded, that is like a magnet to gunfire. And of course, when they see somebody drop out of it, that becomes a secondary magnet. And so everyone's trying to shoot him. There's tracers going everywhere. Larry McKibben pulls out. Roy runs across this thing. On the way, he's shot once. He doesn't even realize he's shot, but he's tripped up. He feels like he's caught up by a thorn, but he actually was shot through the calf. And then a rocket propelled grenade hit almost when he was to the perimeter of this team, this decimated team, and he took shrapnel to the face and the chest. And then he still crawled in. And then at that point, he, you know, without going into all the detail, he formulated and just calmly took control and helped to put together this extraordinary defense to really inflict the most punishment and damage onto this superior enemy force, yet to keep the team there under cover. And then he called in, you know, danger close air support, napalm and whatnot, to encircle this team with a barrier of protection while trying to provide medical assistance as well. It's just one of those moments where there's so much chaos going on, and I just took the time to interview people seeing it from the ground, from the air, the survivors, the statements that were written, to give the reader a taste of just the utter chaos that was going on in this moment. And through it all, everybody over and over again said that this calm that was brought by Roy, because he was there and he had come and he was just very calmly putting it all together and orchestrating this defense while they were just holding on. They were ready to call it quits. They thought they were dead.
I have to say that this section of the book, I read it straight through. I could not put it down. It was that gripping for me, and I can't even remember how many times Roy was wounded. He was stabbed. He was everything else. And folks, you got to read this. His book is legend. It's by Eric Blem. And in fact, when they finally did get everybody out and they got back into Vietnam, they thought that Roy was dead and started putting him into a body bag. That's how badly he was wounded. And
yes.
So we'll stop at that point. They get out. But you have to read this. I mean, whether you were on the ground as an infantry or if you were a pilot, door gunner, crew chief, whatever it was, this story is going to make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And even after you're done reading it and know exactly how everything comes out, it's an amazing story of an amazing man. And Eric, I want to thank you for writing this book. I think it's such a powerful story. And the men and women of today's Army are so similar to people like Roy. And this is what I want people to understand, that this is what a veteran is like. These are the people that are willing to put their lives on the line, not just for you at home, but especially for their buddies on the ground.
Indeed. Indeed.
And so I want to take a real quick break, and then we'll come back, and maybe we'll talk some more about Legend. But you've written some other books. So I want to make sure that we get you the ability to mention those. So we're going to take a real fast break. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Eric Blem, the author of Legend, the story of Green Beret Sergeant Roy Benavidez's heroic mission to rescue a special forces team caught behind enemy lines in Cambodia in 1968. And I'm encouraging, this is, I don't know how I'm going to rate these books. Again, maybe I'll give it 5 stripes for this one. This is one that all of you need to read. Whether you were in Vietnam or not, it explains a lot of what was going on. You're going to understand what the SOG missions were about, these special observation group that was over there, and some of the missions that they ran to try and prevent. I mean, there was a regular, almost a 4-lane highway going down through Laos and Cambodia with all the supplies and so forth that were coming from North Vietnam. But we've got a – hold on just a second. I got to – I don't know who Jerry is. Somebody wanted to know if you used the most current Medal of Honor. Somebody talk to me.
Yeah, he just called in.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure. Did you? We talked about how you got the story. A mother of a friend of yours said you got to talk about this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Oh, I know what I was going to mention to you. In your book, you mentioned a good friend of ours here in the Ann Arbor area, and that's Colonel Chuck Kettles. And mm-hmm. Chuck Kettles is also a helicopter pilot who is whose current commendation is being upgraded to a Medal of Honor for something that he did in Vietnam in 1967. And I just wanted to mention that. So he really is using a lot of sources here. In fact, I've got him on the desk in front of me. So Chuck Kettles is there. I've got my Secret Green Beret Commandos in Cambodia book by Lieutenant Colonel Lindsay. And...
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been on our program too. So
he was so great at introducing me to various individuals that these guys have just been so helpful and so, you know, the families too. You mentioned how if you're part of all this, you want to read the story. And what I think one of the greatest compliments I got was from, I went to the reunion of the 240th.
Okay.
There was a reunion not long ago, and they said how the family members said, you know, they didn't talk about a lot of this. And that's one reason I've told these stories. I was encouraged by the World War II veterans who were, many of them, dying off, and the World War I veterans and never having spoken of their stories. And they said, you know, this book has given me a chance to understand what my dad did, because he could mm-hmm. talk to me about it in a way that he couldn't talk to his son or daughter. And by putting it together, it was just a nice way to let them understand, hey, this is what, you know, my father did, or an uncle or a relative or the guy down the street that wears, you know, always flies the flag and puts a MIA black flag up in front of his house. You know, mm-hmm. these are the people that you get a little bit of insight into. And same with the other books that I've written that are more contemporary. Fearless is the story of SEAL Team 6 operator Adam Brown, who overcame just incredible odds to make it to that top tier of SEAL Team 6. Crack addiction, jail. He was one of these guys who got a second chance with the military and then rose above all of that, ultimately mm-hmm. To put his own life in harm's way in order to protect his teammates. And it's another classic story of a hero who, when he was killed, one of the last things he told his family was that if I ever am killed in combat, you know, don't tell the story of me becoming this SEAL and this hero. Tell the story of who I was when I was this derelict, when I was this scumbag, dirtbag, stealing from my own family in the street, and to give hope to people that, you know, you can be in the dark place, the darkest place in your life, and you can turn it around. And that's, to me, is the epitome of fearlessness, because he was willing to open that closet and show the skeletons of his past in order to do one thing, not to make himself look good, but to inspire others,
right,
and they can rise above.
To give hope.
Yeah, and so that's Fearless. And that, another book I wrote was The Only Thing Worth Dying For, which was the story of ODA 574, Special Forces Team in Afghanistan, one of the first teams in after 9/11, and the first team in to go to the south of Afghanistan, where there was no standing, you know, Northern Alliance or United Front. This is a team that went in to raise a militia, a classic traditional guerrilla warfare situation, to try and foment the Pashtun to rise up above and against the Taliban from within. And it's a story that ends with a friendly fire incident, and it's a story that's really never been told, the rise of Hamid Karzai, who I was able to interview, along with the man who was military advisor to Hamid Karzai. So it's another little piece of history that I think, you know, would have been lost had these men been willing to tell the story to honor the guys who were killed on that mission, but also just to honor history and the truth of what really went on in those early days after 9/11. And those are the two, along with Fearless, that I've dedicated the last decade of my life to research and tell the stories, along with a story called The Last Season, which is not military, but it's a story of a backcountry Park Service ranger who went missing mysteriously while on patrol in the High Sierra, Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. And so I guess the kind of the link or the thread through my career thus far is just telling the stories of those who serve. And it's always an honor to do it. It's an honor to be called on a radio show like yourself that really focuses on exactly that, honoring and also just enlightening people, both veterans and people who are interested in veterans and what they've done, who have a place, a forum to come to and be given information that is not only important but also worthy of people's time, because time is short nowadays, and when someone takes the time to read a book or listen to a radio show, you gotta clap your hands and be thankful for that, because there is so much information out there.
Well, there is, and we just, you know, our goal has always been to get these stories out, and you're certainly one of the authors that we can trust to get the true story out. You know, Roy always said that, you know, and all the Medal of Honors that we've had the privilege of talking to have all said, you know, I'm not the hero. The heroes were the ones that didn't come back. And, you know, and that always takes my breath away when I think about all of the men and women that have not come back. And so that's why we keep telling these stories, because we want to keep them alive as long as we possibly can. And I want to thank you so very much, Eric, for being on Veterans Radio. And I definitely plan on reading those other two and having you back when Legend comes out in paperback. Which, by the way, how do people get a hold of your books?
You know, they're available everywhere books are sold. They're in paper. It's going to come out in paperback in April, although it's available for pre-order now. But it's available in hardcover, audiobook. It's in large print, I believe, as well.
That's
so anywhere books are sold, you know, if you do the online thing, Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or Books a Million, whatever. But I will always urge people, if you have a bookstore in your town that you like to go and walk through the aisles, and maybe they have a coffee house, have a cup of coffee, support them, because they are disappearing at an alarming rate. And it's for philanthropy. You know, some people will support whatever. I tell you, I buy books as often as I can whenever I see a nice bookstore and I get good service, because it's nice to have them there.
And
if you don't buy books, they're not going to be there any much longer.
That's true. So today on Veterans Radio, we talked about Legend by Eric Blehm. That's B-L-E-H-M. And I encourage everybody to go find Eric on the Internet. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Dale, thanks for having me. And again, everybody out there in your listenership, thank you for your service. And the families, thank you for your service.
Thank you very much, Eric. Next week on Veterans Radio, folks, it's music time. We're doing a program called We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War. If you have any favorite songs that you listened to while you were in Vietnam, contact Veterans Radio so we can put you on our playlist next week. Until then, you are dismissed.